A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. Chapter 13. Examples of the Harm Done by Women's Ignorance. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Many follies are to some extent women's follies. Sins against reason, sins of commission as well as of omission, but all flowing from ignorance or prejudice. I shall point out only five of them that appear to be harmful to the woman's moral character. In criticising them, I want especially to show that the weakness of mind and body that men have tried to perpetuate in women prevents them from discharging the special duty of their sex. For when weakness of body won't let them breastfeed their children, and weakness of mind makes them spoil their tempers, is woman in a natural state? First, there are charlatans. One glaring instance of the weakness that comes from ignorance calls for severe reproof. In this city, a number of lurking leeches wickedly make their living by exploiting women's credulity, claiming to cast nativities, to use the technical phrase, i.e., to draw up horoscopes, making predictions on the basis of astrology. And many females, who are proud of their rank and fortune, and look down on the vulgar with sovereign contempt, show by their credulity that the distinction between themselves and the vulgar is arbitrary, and that they have not sufficiently cultivated their minds to rise above vulgar prejudices. Because women haven't been led to regard the knowledge of their duty as the one thing necessary to know, or to live in the present moment by doing their duty, they are anxious to peep into the future, to learn what they have to expect to make life interesting, and to break the vacuum of ignorance. If you, reader, are one of those ladies who are not ashamed to consult one of these cunning men openly, please answer the following questions, remembering that you are in the presence of God. Do you believe that there is only one God, and that He is powerful, wise, and good? Do you believe that all things were created by Him, and that all beings depend on Him? Do you rely on His wisdom, which is so conspicuous in His works, including your own body? And are you convinced that He has ordered all the things that you don't perceive in the same perfect harmony to fulfil His designs? Do you acknowledge that the power of looking into the future and seeing things that are not, as if they were, is an attribute of the Creator? And if He does ever want to impart to His creatures a knowledge of some event that hasn't yet happened, to whom would He reveal the secret by immediate inspiration? The opinion of the ages will answer that last question. He will reveal it to reverend old men, to people distinguished for eminent piety. There is a natural transition from these delusions to the still more fashionable deceptions practised by the whole tribe of magnetisers, i.e., hypnotists. With respect to them also, it is proper to ask women a few questions. Do you know anything about the construction of the human body? If not, you should be told something that every child ought to know, namely that when the body's admirable system has been disturbed by intemperance or inactivity, I'm talking not about violent disorders, but about chronic diseases, it must be returned to a healthy state by slow degrees. If the functions of life haven't been materially injured so that recovery is impossible, the only known ways for recovering that inestimable blessing, health, are through a regimen of temperance, air, exercise, and a few medicines prescribed by persons who have studied the human body. They are, at least, the only ways that will bear investigation. Do you believe that these magnetizers, who by hocus-pocus tricks pretend to work a miracle, are delegated by God or assisted by the devil? When the magnetizers put to flight, so they claim, disorders that have baffled the powers of medicine, are they working in conformity to the light of reason? Or do they bring about these wonderful cures by supernatural aid? A magnetizer may answer, "We do it by communicating with the world of spirits." "A noble privilege, we must admit. These men are very fortunate in becoming acquainted with such obliging spirits, but we can't give the spirits much credit for wisdom or goodness in choosing to show themselves the benevolent friends of man with the aid of these men. It is, however, little short of blasphemy to claim to have such powers. From the overall way that God runs the world, it seems evident to sober reason that certain vices produce certain effects. Can anyone so grossly insult God's wisdom as to suppose that a magnetizing miracle will be allowed to disturb his general laws, restoring intemperate and vicious people to health, merely to enable them to go back to their old ways with impunity? Be whole and sin no more, said Jesus. Are greater miracles to be performed by those who do not follow in the footsteps of him who healed the body in order to reach the mind? The mention of the name of Christ, after such vile impostors, may displease you. I respect your warmth. But don't forget that the followers of these magnetizing delusions call themselves Christians, and profess to be disciples of him who said, "By their fruits ye shall know them," i.e., know who are the children of God, and who are the servants of sin. It's certainly easier to touch the body of a saint, or to be magnetized, i.e., hypnotized, than it is to restrain our appetites or govern our passions. But health of body or mind can only be recovered by those restraints. If there is another way, namely through magnetizing, then the supreme judge is biased and revengeful. Is God a man, that he should punish out of resentment? Reason tells us that God, our common Father, wounds only in order to heal. Our irregularities produce certain consequences, and that forcibly shows us the nature of vice. In that way, we learn from experience to know good from evil, so that we will love one and hate the other in proportion to our degree of wisdom. The poison contains the antidote, and we either reform our evil habits and stop sinning against our own bodies, to use the forcible language of Scripture, or the thread of our life is snapped by a premature death, the punishment of sin. This raises a question that is frightening to discuss, but why should I conceal my views? Considering God's attributes, I believe that whatever punishment may follow a sin will tend to show the malignity of vice, the purpose of reformation. Positive punishment, i.e., punishment that is not inflicted because of its consequences, appears to be so contrary to the nature of God as we understand it, that I would find it easier to believe that the Deity paid no attention to men's conduct than that he punished without the benevolent design of reforming. I know that many devout people boast of submitting blindly to God's will, as to an arbitrary scepter or rod. In other words, like people in the common concerns of life, they do homage to power, and cringe under the foot that can crush them. Rational religion, on the other hand, is a submission to the will of a being who is so perfectly wise that everything he wills must be reasonable. And if we respect God in this way, can we believe the mysterious insinuations that insult his laws? Can we believe, even if it stares us in the face, that God would work a miracle to authorize confusion by sanctioning an error? Yet we must either allow these impious conclusions, or treat with contempt every promise to restore health to a diseased body by supernatural means, or to foretell the incidents that only God can foresee. Secondly, there is the reading of novels. Another instance of feminine weakness of character that is often produced by a confined education is a romantic twist of the mind that has been very properly called sentimental. Women, subjected by ignorance to their sensations, and taught to look for happiness only in love, take a subtle approach to sensual feelings, and adopt metaphysical notions about love that lead them to neglect shamefully the duties of life, and frequently, in the midst of these lofty refinements, they plunge into actual vice. These are the women who pass their time with the daydreams of the stupid novelists who, knowing little of human nature, work up stale tales, and describe tarted-up scenes, all narrated in a sentimental jargon that corrupts the reader's taste and draws the heart away from its daily duties. I don't mention the understanding, because it has never been exercised, so that its slumbering energies rest inactive. Because females are denied all political privileges, and as married women are denied even a civil existence, their attention is naturally drawn from the interests of the whole community to the interests of the tiny parts. The mighty business of female life is to please, and for them, blocked by political and civil oppression from entering into more important concerns, sentiments become important events. When they reflect on these feelings, they intensify them, whereas reflection ought to erase them, and would do so if the understanding were allowed to take a wider range. Confined to trivial activities, women naturally imbibe the opinions expressed in the only kind of reading that can interest an innocent, frivolous mind. Unable to grasp anything great, they naturally find the reading of history a very dry task, and find anything that is addressed to the understanding to be intolerably tedious and almost unintelligible. So they have to depend on the novelist for amusement. When I criticize novels, I am attacking them as contrasted with works that exercise the understanding and regulate the imagination. I'm not saying that the reading of novels is absolutely bad. I regard any kind of reading as better than leaving a blank still a blank, because the mind must be a little enlarged and a little strengthened by the slight exertion of its thinking powers that novel reading may bring. And novels that are addressed only to the imagination and provide nothing to think about, even they raise the reader a little above the gross gratification of appetites that haven't been subjected to any kind of thought. I knew a woman, as good a woman as her narrow mind would allow her to be, who took care that her three daughters should never see a novel. She was a woman of fortune and fashion, so the daughters had various masters to attend them, and a sort of menial governess to watch their footsteps. From their masters they learnt how tables, chairs, etc. are called in French and Italian, but they acquired neither ideas nor sentiments, because the few books thrown in their way were either far above their capacities or devotional. When they weren't being compelled to repeat words, they spent their time in dressing, quarrelling with each other, or secretly conversing with their maids, until at last they were brought into company as marriageable. Their mother, a widow, was busy in the meantime keeping up her connections, as she called her acquaintances, so as to ensure her girls a proper introduction into the great world. And these young ladies, with spoiled temperaments and minds that were vulgar in every sense of the word, entered life puffed up with notions of their own importance and contempt for anyone who couldn't compete with them in dress and parade. As for love, nature or their nurses had taken care to teach them the physical meaning of the word. And as they had few topics of conversation, and even fewer refinements of sentiment, they expressed their gross wishes in not very delicate phrases when they had free conversations about marriage. This is only one instance, but I recollect many other women who, not having been led gradually to proper studies or permitted to choose for themselves, have indeed been overgrown children. They may have obtained, by mixing in the world, a little of what is called common sense, which is a distinct manner of seeing common events as they stand detached, i.e., seeing each event in isolation. What they didn't have was anything deserving the name intellect, the power of gaining general or abstract ideas. Their minds were quiescent, and when they were not roused by sensible objects and activities of that kind, they were low-spirited, tearful, or sleepy. So when I advise my sex not to read such flimsy works as novels, it is to induce them to read something better. Thirdly, there is dressing up. Ignorance, and the mistaken cunning that nature sharpens in weak heads as a means of self-preservation, make women very fond of dress, and produce the vanity that such a fondness naturally generates, to the exclusion of spirited attempts to grow and improve. I agree with Rousseau that the physical part of the art of pleasing consists in ornaments, and for just that reason I want to guard girls against the contagious fondness for dress that is so common to weak women, so that they don't remain stuck in the physical part. Women who think they can long please without the aid of the mind, i.e. without the moral art of pleasing, must be weak indeed. The moral art is never accompanied by ignorance. It is essentially different from, and superior to, the sportiveness of innocence that is so pleasing to refined libertines of both sexes. A strong inclination for external ornaments always appears in primitive societies, though in those only the men adorn themselves, not the women. The attention to dress, therefore, which has been thought a feminine propensity, is natural to all mankind, I think. But I ought to express myself with more precision. When the mind is not sufficiently opened to take pleasure in reflection, the body will be adorned with sedulous care, and ambition will appear in tattooing or painting it. This first inclination is carried so far that even the hellish yoke of slavery cannot stifle the savage desire for admiration that the black heroes inherit from both their parents. For all the hardly earned savings of a slave are commonly expended in a little tawdry finery. And I have seldom known a good male or female servant who was not particularly fond of dress. Their clothes were their riches. And I argue from analogy that the fondness for dress, so extravagant in females, arises from the same cause, lack of cultivation of mind. When men meet, they converse about business, politics, or literature. But, says Swift, how naturally do women apply their hands to each other's lappets and ruffles? And very natural it is, for they have not any business to interest them, have not a taste for literature, and find politics dry, because they have not acquired a love for mankind by thinking about the grand pursuits that exalt the human race and promote general happiness. Also, although men of the same profession are seldom friends, there is a much greater number of their fellow creatures with whom they never clash. But women are very differently situated with respect to each other, for they are all rivals. Before marriage, it is their business to please men, and after marriage most of them follow the same scent with all the persistence of instinct. Even virtuous women never forget their femaleness in company, for they are always trying to be agreeable. A female beauty and a male wit seem to be equally anxious to draw the attention of the company to themselves, and the animosity of contemporary wits is proverbial. So it's not surprising that the sole ambition of women centres on beauty, and that there are perpetual rivalries. They're all running the same race. They would rise above the virtue of mortals if they didn't view each other with a suspicious and even envious eye. Fourthly, sensibility or sensitivity. Women are supposed to have more sensibility than men, and even more humanity, and their strong attachments and instantaneous emotions of compassion are cited as proofs of this. But the clinging affection of an ignorant person seldom has anything noble in it. Like the affections of children and the lower animals, it is mostly a form of selfishness. I have known many weak women whose sensibility was entirely taken up by their husbands, and as for their humanity, it was very faint indeed, or rather it was only a transient emotion of compassion. This exclusive kind of affection, though it degrades the individual, shouldn't be offered as evidence of the inferiority of the female sex, because it is the natural consequence of confined views. Even women of superior sense, when their attention is focused on little employments and private plans, rarely rise to heroism. I therefore agree with the moralist Adam Smith, who says that women seldom have as much generosity as men, and that their narrow affections, often put ahead of justice and humanity, make the sex apparently inferior. But I contend that the heart would expand as the understanding gained strength if women were not held down from their cradles. I know that a little sensibility and great weakness will produce a strong attachment to members of one's own sex, and that friendship is made stronger by reason. So more friendship is to be found in the male than in the female world, and men have a higher sense of justice. The narrowly focused affections of women seemed to resemble Cato's most unjust love for his country. He wished to crush Carthage, not to save Rome, but to promote its vainglory. Besides, how can women be just or generous when they are the slaves of injustice? Fifthly, ignorance about child care. As the rearing of children, i.e. the laying of a foundation of sound health, both of body and mind, in the rising generation, has justly been insisted on as the task assigned mainly to women, their ignorance about it must be contrary to the order of things. If they are to become sensible mothers, I contend their minds will have to take in much more than they now do, and they can do so. Many men attend to the breeding of horses, and supervise the management of the stable, and would think themselves degraded by paying any attention to the nursery, while many children neglected by their fathers are absolutely murdered by the ignorance of women. And of the children who are not destroyed by unnatural negligence or blind fondness, very few are managed properly with respect to the infant mind. A child's spirit is allowed to become vicious at home, so the child is sent to school to have his or her spirit broken, and the methods the school uses, and must use to keep a number of children in order, sow the seeds of almost every vice in the soil that has been forcibly torn up. These poor children ought never to have felt restraint, and would not have felt it if they had always been held in with an even hand. I have sometimes compared their struggles to the despairing plunges of a spirited filly that I have seen being broken in on a beach, its feet sinking deeper and deeper in the sand every time it tried to throw its rider, till at last it sullenly submitted. I have always found horses, an animal I am attached to, very tractable when treated with humanity and steadiness, so I suspect that the violent methods taken to break them in do not essentially injure them. I am certain, however, that a child should never be thus forcibly tamed, after it has unwisely been allowed to run wild, for every violation of justice and reason in the treatment of children weakens their reason. They catch a character so early. Experience leads me to infer that the base of the moral character is fixed before their 7th year, the period during which women are allowed the sole management of children. Afterwards, it too often happens that half the business of education is to try to correct the faults that the children would never have acquired if their mothers had had more understanding. One striking instance of the folly of women must be mentioned, namely their treatment of servants in the presence of children, allowing the children to think that the servants ought to wait on them and to put up with their moods. A child should always be made to receive assistance from a man or woman as a favour, and as the first lesson of independence they should learn from their mother's example not to require personal attendance, that it is an insult to humanity to require unless one is ill. I have often indignantly heard servants being imperiously sent for to put children to bed, and then being sent away again and again because master or miss hung about mamma so as to stay up a little longer. End of the main part of chapter 13. Concluding reflections on the moral improvement that a revolution in female manners might naturally be expected to produce. Now that I enter onto my concluding reflections, I need not inform the sagacious reader that the discussion of this subject consists merely in opening a few simple principles and clearing away the rubbish that obscured them. But not all readers are sagacious, so I must be allowed to add some explanatory remarks to bring the subject home to reason, to that sluggish reason that takes opinions on trust and sticks by them to spare itself the labour of thinking. Moralists have unanimously agreed that unless virtue is nursed by liberty, it will never attain due strength. And what they say of man, I extend to mankind, insisting that in all cases morals must be fixed on immutable principles, and that no one who obeys any authority but that of reason can be termed rational or virtuous. To render women truly useful members of society, they should be led, by having their understandings cultivated on a large scale, to acquire a rational affection for their country. This affection must be founded on knowledge, because it is obvious that we have little interest concerning what we do not understand. And to make this general knowledge of due importance, I have tried to show that private duties are never properly fulfilled unless the understanding enlarges the heart, and that public virtue is only an aggregate of private virtues. But the distinctions established in society undermine both by beating out the solid gold of virtue until it becomes only the tinsel covering of vice. For as long as wealth makes a man more respectable than virtue, wealth will be sought before virtue. And as long as women's persons are caressed, the mind will lie fallow. Yet true voluptuousness must proceed from the mind, for what can equal the sensations produced by mutual affection, supported by mutual respect? Compared with the modest overflowings of a pure heart and exalted imagination, what are the cold or feverish caresses of appetite, but sin embracing death? Yes, let me tell the libertine of fancy, when he despises understanding in woman, that the mind that he disregards gives life to the enthusiastic affection that is the only source from which rapture, short-lived as it is, can flow, and that without virtue a sexual attachment must expire, like a tallow candle in the socket guttering out with a stink and creating intolerable disgust. To prove this, I need only observe that men who have wasted a great part of their lives with women, and with whom they have sought for pleasure with eager thirst, have the meanest opinion of the female sex. It is not to be disputed, I think, that women today are made foolish or vicious by ignorance, and this observation makes it at least probable that the best effects for the health of mankind might be expected from a revolution in female manners. For just as marriage has been called the parent of those endearing charities that separate man from the lower animals, the corrupting interactions that wealth, idleness, and folly produce between the sexes are more universally injurious to morality than all the other vices of mankind collectively considered. To adulterous lust, the most sacred duties are sacrificed, because men, before they were married, learned to regard love as a selfish gratification, learned to separate it not only from esteem, but from the habitual affection that has some element of humanity mixed into it. Children will never be properly educated until friendship subsists between parents, virtue flies from a house divided against itself, and a whole legion of devils takes up residence there. The affection of husbands and wives cannot be pure when they have so few sentiments in common, and when so little confidence is established at home, as must be the case when their pursuits are so different, that intimacy from which tenderness should flow will not, cannot, subsist between the vicious. Most female follies come, I firmly believe, from the tyranny of man, and the cunning that at present characterizes women is, as I have repeatedly tried to prove, produced by oppression. Asserting the rights that women as well as men ought to contend for, I have been trying not to extenuate women's faults, but to prove them to be the natural consequence of their education and station in society. If that is right, it is reasonable to suppose that they will change their character and correct their vices and follies when they are allowed to be free in a physical, moral, and civil sense. End of chapter 13. End of the work.